Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and this podcast is ranked in the top 2% of the most popular podcasts globally, and it's all because of my incredible guests. I'm just here to facilitate the conversation. I am honored and blessed to share time with people who are at the top of their game, and they come on this show willing to help you get to where you want to be in life and in business. These are not people who hold back. Their goal is to share with us the essence of peak performance. And today our topic is storytelling for business. Storytelling has always been an important part of any successful business. It helps to engage customers and create a powerful connection between the company and the customer. And storytelling is a great way to introduce products and services as well as to explain their purpose. It can be used to establish an emotional connection with customers, increase brand loyalty, and build relationships. And the power of storytelling for business is undeniable. It provides a unique opportunity to draw in current customers and attract new guests, or new customers. And my guest today, Will, I know I asked you this, is Sacklos, right?
Yes, correct. Very
oh,
good.
Right. It's spelled very differently, and I'll get you to explain this. Go ahead. But anyway, Will is a former, we're having a little bit of trouble speaking across one another, so I'm trying to be careful, but bear with us. So Will is a former senior creative executive and story consultant at Pixar Animation Studios. That's a story all by itself. And in addition to providing story consulting and story repair on Finding Nemo, Monsters, Inc., I love that story, love the movie, and Ratatouille, an open season, Will taught his singular story development course to directors, heads of story, story artists, and top executives at Pixar, Sony, and Disney, and in publicly available classes in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he was discovered by Andrew Stanton and recruited to Pixar. Will, welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm excited to have you here. I love storytelling. I think a friend of yours, Karen Eber, was also here just recently talking about storytelling. A friend of mine who I adore, Ken Atchity, and I think I introduced him to you, storytelling, story merchant. This is a topic that I'm really passionate about because, to me, when you're telling stories and you're telling them properly, that shows such authenticity. Authentic story. So, it's Monday, right?
Yeah.
Authenticity, there's the word. But listen, welcome. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you, Denise. It's really great to be with you.
Okay, tell me very quickly, Karen Eber, you're going to be in her book?
Yes. She has a great book coming out in 2023 about storytelling, and her focus is, mine has been a little bit more actually, you know, applied to film, feature films and dramatic storytelling. But her book, I think, is more for storytelling in business. But the principles overlap quite a bit. I mean, the principles of sound storytelling, I think, are universal across platforms. In other words, for me, if it's live action or animation or if it's, you know, a business application, the principles of great storytelling are the same.
And that makes sense. And, you know, it's interesting because I've been in business since 2001. I just realized that the other day, well, recently, and it occurred to me that I've been in business over 20 years, and that shocked me because when you're doing things that you love, you're like, oh, you know, I need to get better. I can do this. You know, and you're always growing and, you know, building. And then all of a sudden you realize, I haven't done this for a long time, but I'm still growing. I'm still building. But authenticity and storytelling, to me, has not been covered enough. I mean, we're changing as we present ourselves on the internet, as business people or entrepreneurs, solopreneurs. We're having to find our voice, which is very different than what we were taught back in the day. You know, just tell people what you want them to know. You know, give them all the information, bury them in information that they don't care about, like your, you know, what kind of degree do you have? I have one. You have one. We don't care. Nobody cares. They just want to know what we can do for them. And storytelling, to me, is just such a critical part of that, authentic storytelling.
Yeah, that reminds me of how I actually got to Pixar. And I think it had to do with the choice to put my voice out there to kind of take a risk. I had decided, well, I had been playing music, not on a like grand level, like more like in bar bands, you know, playing guitar, stumbling in at 3 a.m. I decided to go back to school, and I got my master's degree in literature. And I got a job teaching at Academy of Art in San Francisco. So, and I was writing screenplays. I had a script that was a Sundance Screenwriters Lab finalist. And so I would write in the morning, and then I would go and I would teach at Academy of Art in the afternoon. It's around noon. And then I would walk up the hill to the Ritz-Carlton in San Francisco and wait tables from 4 to midnight. And I did this for a while. And while I was teaching this course, I had a friend that taught screenwriting there, and I thought, well, I could teach that. I got a shiny new master's degree. I've written a script that had some success. And I had an interview, and the head of the school, the dean, said, you know what you'd be good at teaching is graduate aesthetics. And I thought, of course I would. I had no idea what aesthetics was. So I had to look it up as the philosophy of art. But so I used everything, plays and movies and poems and music, everything about art to kind of get at what it was about, particularly dramatic arts. And I developed a theory of dramatic construction that was really workable and felt really true. So I started teaching these sort of guerrilla courses on my own, where I just rent like a room at a meeting room at a hotel or there's a place, Fort Mason in San Francisco, where you could rent classrooms. And I sent out flyers back in those days. You know, you didn't just have a big long text list or even much of an email list. We actually sent physical flyers. So I happened to pick up the local paper and saw that A Bug's Life had just come out. And there was a picture and the names of the four primary creative people at Pixar. And I got the address over in Point Richmond where they were. And I sent flyers to each of them. The top creative people in the company. And I wrote, hey, you know, it was John Lasseter, Pete Docter, and Andrew Stanton, and Joe Ramps. And I, you know, wrote on the flyer, hey, Joe, hey, Andrew, you know, I just, congratulations on A Bug's Life, doing this course, and just wanted to let you know, and blah, 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 like I knew them. They didn't know me from Adam. And I got a call from, I got an email from one of them, Andrew Stanton, who was a brilliant writer-director who wrote almost all the early scripts, including Toy Story, and directed Finding Nemo and WALL-E. And he came down and took my course in the city, which I started teaching on my nights off from the restaurant. So after 8 weeks, he handed me his card and said, call me. And I did, and they brought me in and interviewed me, and that's how I went, how I became the story consultant and then senior creative director at Pixar within about a month or so. And that's when I gave my notice at the restaurant.
I was just going to ask, did you quit the Ritz-Carlton? It's one of my favorite places in San Francisco, truly. When every time I would go, I'm sorry. See, we're cutting up each other. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, it was a great job. There were great people, and everything was, you know, top shelf, and it had to be done right. And it was the highest ranked Zagat restaurant rated in a big restaurant city back in those days in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Every time I would go home to visit my mom, we always went to the Ritz-Carlton, always. It was just one of those mother-daughter things.
Sweet.
Well, she's gone now, but and I don't go back to San Francisco if I can avoid it. But it's just, I used to love going there. These days, not so much for just so many reasons. But I have very fond memories of the city.
Mm-hmm. It's a really fun city and cosmopolitan and fabulous culture and beautiful. Yeah.
It is. It really is. So you have done, I've got, going from San Francisco to Louisiana, let's go there, because you did field research, and there's a little town, y'all, I promise you, called Cut Off, Louisiana, and you did the field research for the Princess and the Frog, where an aspiring Buddhist kills half the creatures in Bayou Lafourche. I got that.
Was neat.
How do you go from San Francisco to Bayou Lafourche, you know?
Well, we initiated that story, the Princess and the Frog story at Pixar, and we sent it over, eventually went to Disney to complete it. And so I was the top development person. I was doing the research for it, and I had made several trips to New Orleans, which I loved, and I got to meet Ava K. Jones, who was the voodoo priestess of New Orleans, who's just a lovely, generous, spiritual woman. And then we met a woman, Anne Galjour, out here, who came to Pixar and did one of her plays. She was from a Cajun family, and she did plays about this great flood in the bayou, and just fascinating. And she was so great, she arranged for us to go and stay with her family in Cut Off, Louisiana, which you're the only person that's heard of it. And
pretty much. Although, I have to tell you, I mentioned Ken Achety earlier. He was born here in Louisiana, so I'm sure he knows where Cut Off is.
Yeah. it was just the loveliest family, the Galjours. They could not have been more generous. And we got the full experience. It took a few other Pixar people, including the president at Capitol, he came along. The father, his name is Carol, he was just this lovely man and a great storyteller, one day took us out on the bayou fishing. And so this where we add in, at this point in my life, I was really trying to become a Buddhist. I was studying. I was going to classes like 3 nights a week and weekend services. And that's just where I was in my life. And so we go out fishing. And I wasn't going to be a bad guest. And I was the only one that caught any fish. And Carol kept baiting my hook with these old shrimp, and every time I just pull in another fish, one after another, after another, after another. I'm like, oh my God. And later in the week, we decided, it was the next night, to take them out, the Galjours, out for dinner. And we had to go, I don't know, it seemed like a long way. It's like 20, 30 miles through the bayou. Pitch black, no lights, no nothing except this road, 2-lane road, and we had this rented SUV with got the bright lights on, and I'm driving, and it seemed like every 500 feet I'd run over a turtle or a frog or a snake, and these bugs are hitting the windshield, they're bouncing off these moths the size of hummingbirds, and I'm going, oh my God, I reverted quickly to my Christian roots and said, oh dear God in heaven, please don't let me kill another living thing today. Yeah, that's what I recall about Bayou LaForche.
Well, and the thing, we joke that we have mosquitoes that will lift your car up and haul off with them. I'm not sure we're really joking. Everything around here, every insect, every critter, they're all huge. I don't know what that's all about. Maybe there's something in the ground that just really feeds them, but yeah, you're right. There's a lot of crittering happening around this part of the country. We have squirrels.
Yeah.
I mean, every once in a while, rarely, because normally I see them coming, but I remember about a year ago I accidentally ran over a squirrel, and I'm still upset over that. I stopped and said, I'm so sorry. I was on one of the back roads. I was taking my dog to get her bath and, you know, her nails done, and I hit a squirrel. It broke my heart.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly because I have them all over my backyard. I mean, you know, they're my buddies out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, so much wildlife down there, and I think because, you know, there's so much, seem like so much pristine country where they just thrive, and I don't know if, you know, it's because they're left, you know, to just thrive, or it's the environment with the, you know, the humidity and the bayou,
Of course, we have the swamp. You know, we have the Atchafalaya swamp, which is, you know, second only to the Everglades. It's a big swamp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's right down the road from me, too. So, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting part of the country. It's, you know, humid most of the time. I mean, it's so humid here, and it's so wet that I tell anybody, listen, Southern women, we don't get wrinkled because we don't ever dry out. We just don't dry enough to get wrinkled. But I'm telling you, the humidity. And right now, I was mentioning to you in the green room, it's cold. We get about 9 or 10 in a row days of winter. And we're lucky if we get them all in one go. But because of the humidity, when it gets cold, it drops down to about 40 degrees. It will go straight to the bone. You don't get warm. Mm-hmm. You have to take hot showers to warm back up.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting part of the country. So when you, and I'm glad that you were able to experience that. So, but let's go, because we talked about the Ritz-Carlton, we talked about Bayou LaForche. And where did you go for dinner, by the way? Do you remember?
On that particular trip? You know, I don't. I, it was not like the Ritz-Carlton, I'll tell you that. It was more like, you know, it was more like a chain restaurant. I don't remember what it was, but it was still like a big deal. There was just not much around there,
no.
At least that we knew about. There might have been some hidden gem, that, you know, but they appreciated it, and it was fun.
Oh, I'm sure. One thing about this part of the country, the food is spectacular. And you're talking about turtles and, you know, squirrel. Look, I'm in the middle of Cajun country. If it doesn't get away quick enough, it winds up on the table. So just be warned. It's true. They won't cook anything. Okay, so you went from – go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, it just reminded me of talking with this family. They were telling – you know, let's say great storytellers, or one of the things that stuck in my mind was that, you know, they would barter, and they would go, you know, to the dentist or some service that they needed, and they would bring, you know, turtle soup or a bag of turtles, or, you know, that would be their payment. And it was just, you know, fascinating. It took us to way in the bayou to this place where they raised albino alligators. I don't even think this was legal, but they kept them in these big tanks that I think were dark. But, and we're in the middle of nowhere, and I was just so I just got such a kick out of meeting the man that was his business, and he had this, real thick Cajun accent and sweet man. And I'll just never forget, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the woods, he pulls up and he's got this big Escalade, and he cuts out and he has bib overalls on, and they are pressed like from the dry cleaner. And he's wearing a Rolex that he's must have weighed about 10 pounds. And we're shuffling through all this mud, and he opens up this tank, and there are this slew of big white alligators ready to snap at us. And so I had all these great and moments in Louisiana. And then we had the best food and best fantastic music in New Orleans, and it was just a wonderful, just love that part of the country.
If you ever get the opportunity, you need to come in the spring when we have Festival International de Louisiana, which runs pretty much concurrently with the Jazz Fest. So you can go back and forth down the highway from Lafayette to New Orleans, eat yourself silly, listen to some of the best music in the world. I'll send you some links. It's coming up pretty soon.
Okay.
But you're talking about, I think you would really, really enjoy it. So what makes a story great? You're telling some terrific stories. And because I live here and because I've seen pretty much everything that you're talking about, I'm actually rewriting what you're telling me in my own experiences. Isn't that what makes a great story? Because you're inviting people to go, ooh, I've done that before, and kind of overlay it with their own experiences, or, ooh, I want to do that. Where do I find more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that I think of this in terms of like film stories, but I think it's again, universal. There's a couple of things about, one of the things we always talked about was, finding the universal idea and, getting people involved emotionally right away. And, great stories are about something. They're about something we can relate to. And in Toy Story, for example, it's about being Woody was the center of attention, and it was akin to being, the firstborn in your family or the most popular kid in school, and maybe more universal, being the firstborn, and then, your little brother or sister comes along, and then you're not the primary person, and where you thought you were, your status has changed and you have to adjust to that. And that was a big deal for Woody, and the idea of being left behind, and then how to create a friendship. And in Toy Story 2, at the heart of that was the idea of mortality, about, our antagonist was the toy collector. And this idea came up, then was it better to be to love and be loved, knowing that that will come to an end, and this is in the life of toys, but it relates to everybody, or is it better to be remain untouched, unmarked, as the toy collector says, mint condition, mint in the box, and or to give in, give your heart fully, knowing that at some point that love, that relationship will come to an end. And that's our scenario was growing when that love partner, the child, grows into adulthood, and that love affair with the toy ends. But that can apply to all of us. And I think that gives weight to stories, things that we can relate to, even if we don't spell them out. We feel them deeply, and there needs to be that sense of truth about them, and that's what we respond to primarily.
And see, that makes sense. I have, when you're reading a book or when you're watching a movie, and, I'll be honest with you, I'm not a movie person or a TV person. I drive Ken Ashety nuts because this is what y'all do. I was like, I'm sorry. I'm just, you have to really grab my attention. But when I tell you, I love Monsters, Inc. And you mentioned Wall-E. I love that. But they make me think. They grab my attention. I'm listening, and at some level, and I'll revisit it, you know, down the road. Think, oh, I've heard that or saw that in a movie or read it in a book. And all of a sudden, I'm off on a different path going, huh, now that makes sense. Mm. But aren't these created, when you're writing these things, aren't they meant to stay with you at some level? Isn't that what you want?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the ultimate, is to have them touch people's hearts that, you know, that they, in a creative way, align with people's feelings and experience, you know, in a way that's different, that lets them see their own lives in a different way, perhaps. And I think there's, you know, there's things that go into that. I think that you know, the group I worked with at Pixar in those early days, and I would say that I was very fortunate because I believe that when I worked at Pixar, I think that was the second golden age of animation. We had a string of extraordinary, we made a string of extraordinary hit movies, including Toy Story, Toy Story 2, Monsters, Inc., Finding Nemo, The Incredibles, Wall-E, Up. And each one of those was deeply felt, beautifully expressed, and unique. And I think it was akin to Disney's golden age and started in 1937 with Pinocchio, and then with Snow White, Fantasia, Dumbo, Bambi, all unique, all deeply felt and beautifully expressed, so that, you know, people felt what those movies were about, were moved by them. And one of the things I realized, well, part of this comes from the people that create them, that they have a good heart, and they have the willingness. And we were in a company that supported this, the idea of giving space to getting it right, iteration after iteration, until, you know, we have that, that's it. I feel it. And so that was something special.
See, I'm fascinated by this because I've watched most of the movies that you're talking about. I have not seen, there's a couple of them that I haven't seen, but over the years I've watched just about all of them. And they've all stuck with me. Mm. Monsters, Inc. is honestly, I think, one of my favorites.
Oh, that's great to hear. Now,
well, and you talked in our pre-interview about how to repair a broken story, and your case study was Monsters, Inc. And I kept thinking, how could that have been broken? It's perfect. So tell me how you had to repair that story.
That's interesting because, you know, we would never say the movie comes out perfect, but we get those, all those movies were, you know, those movies I mentioned, I think, you know, turned out great. Not only were they huge box office hits, but people loved them, and they were critically acclaimed as well. But in every one of those, there was a point, because they took years to make. I mean, in the early days, they took 3, sometimes 4 years to make. And we spent at least a year, sometimes 2 years, just getting the story right, which is really critical because it's so easy. We had the best story artist, a storyboard artist that can create visual gags that were so entertaining. We had the best character designers, and we could get the best actors and composers, and we learned that we knew that you could have all of those fabulous elements, but if the story itself is not sound from start to finish and through to its core, all of those fabulous elements combined won't turn an average or okay story into a great story, or an okay movie into a great movie. And I forget your question.
I was going to ask you, you know, how you have a case study. How do you repair a broken story? But I want to go back. Once you tell me about that, I want to go back to what you just said about composers. And I'm thinking John Williams, Star Wars. Like, I only watched that movie once, but I know all the music. Don't we all?
Yes. Yes. That's really powerful. And and part of it is that, you know, in that film was just so so perfectly put together and structured. And I think, you know, that the music on its own, you know, it's fabulous, but married to those moments, those heroic moments when it really sings, it just sinks into your bones, and it is unforgettable. But I think without the story, experience it with the story, it's not the same, even though the music is great.
It's not. Hogwarts. I mean, I was turned on YouTube the other day, and I'm a big Harry Potter fan. Those movies I watch, I watch them every year. I have an entire month I watch the whole series. But there's a YouTube video that has all of the, you know, different sections. You know, here you're in the Great Room, here you're in Gryffindor, and all the music that's in there. And I can be washing dishes, I can be doing, you know, fighting with the cat, who knows. And I'll hear something, and I'm right back in that movie. But you're right, it's that moment in that movie that I identify because of just a few chords of music. It's important.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. I think it's just such a powerful combination of the visual, not just the visual, the story, the emotional story moment, and the music that supports that and amplifies that is just very powerful.
It is. So I'm not going to interrupt again, I think. I promise. Pixar's Monsters, how was it broken?
Okay, well, that may sound a little harsh, but that's, this is what I meant to say, and this is part of the story of this, is that we set up, when you mentioned all those films, you know, came out like perfect, there was a point in every single one where we looked at where we put them together on what we called on reels, where there was like hand-drawn animation and we called scratch voices, where we had, you know, employees and we had lots of hams there that would do the voices of characters. And so we could see the movie on screen. It was like a comic book version of it and really work it and refine it. And it was a great process. But in every single one of those movies, there was a point where, like John Lasseter would say, or Andrew would say, you know, this is just one big pile of crap. You know, we're just, this is,
ouch.
I mean, every single one. And again, it was that willingness to get it right and have the people that cared enough to get it right, and somehow inside have the instincts and the heart to know when it was right. So on Monsters, we would go to these screenings all the way through, you know, which were from where it was very, every movie from was very sort of this crude rendering to where it was partially finished. It was mostly finished. And we had, in those days, we had a partnership with Disney. They helped with financing, and then they were a great distribution partner. So we had to run things by them to get final approval before they, you know, took over and marketed and distributed the film. And so they had already approved Monsters at the point where it was, and I looked at it and I thought, you know, there's something off here. And I had a conversation, a meeting with Ed Catmull, the president, who was a brilliant scientist, and one of the things great about, and Steve Jobs, you know, owned Pixar, and they just, as a quick aside, part of the brilliance of that, like, creative bubble in those years was Steve had the sense to hire the best people, the most talented people, and then let them do what they do. And I had worked for other studios afterwards where they would hire the best people and tell them what to do. And there's a huge difference. And Ed always said, my job is just to, like, bring the right people together in teams capable of making magic. And so that's a little aside, but giving us the room to make mistakes and to get it right. So I sat down with him and he, what's going on with this movie? I said, well, it really, you know, there's all these great visual gags. There's, you know, great character designs. It's, you know, and, but it's sags in the middle. And ultimately it's just, it doesn't add up to that much. And he said, what can we do? And so I looked at it, studied it more and more and more. And so it was at a point where, just as a quick reminder, I mean, the movie takes place in the monster's world. And this was this great premise that Pete Docter came up with, about the monsters that sneak into little kids' bedrooms at night and terrify them, and that this is a job for them, and they live in this world. And you know, the city is called Monstropolis, and they work for a company called Monsters Inc. And the monsters collect the screams from the kids, terrifying them, and put them in canisters. And then this is the fuel that runs their world, like gas and electric. It's like, you know, scream power. It's like a fossil fuel. And then one of the main rules or beliefs of this world is that kids are toxic. There's like, a, you know, be a plague if one got in. And no, by no means should a kid ever get into Monstropolis. It would be a disaster. So we got to a point where we had Sully, who was the lead character, played by John Goodman, and his best friend and roommate, Mike Wazowski, played by Billy Crystal. They were working in the basement of Monsters, Inc., the factory company, wrangling canisters of scream, which, you know, were collected and then, you know, turned into fumes. And while working in the basement, they, Sully discovers that this little girl, Boo, has somehow gotten through one of the portals, the, you know, the closets where the monsters come out in the bedrooms, and escaped into Monster World. And at first they want to, you know, they try to get her back and we've got to get rid of her. This is a disaster. And then he starts to care for her and fall in love with her and wants her. And then his goal becomes to get her home. So what was happening with the film is that they're working in the basement. What they're doing, him pursuing his goal of getting her home, does not have a big effect on the world. And that's, because of that, the film feels flat. So in order to create excitement, or what we call rising action, which is the increase of conflict and complication, or you want it to get more exciting, we're just sort of putting, you know, obstacles in front of the character, like, you know, he can't get to the door, or he's going to be seen, or something like that. And it's not enough. It's not enough to create sustainable rising action. And so I said, you know, part of this idea that I developed, you know, when I was teaching at Academy of Art and based my classes on, was this, an idea of that, a realization that the action taken by a motivated character moving toward a goal has to have an effect on another character or characters with whom they have a significant relationship. And so there's pushback. Someone opposes the you know, the character trying to achieve his goal, and that's how you get real, you know, conflict. So I said, we've got to bring Sully out of the basement, and he can't be anonymous. He's got to be like the top scarer in the company. He's got to be the Michael Jordan of scarers. Now when he has this taboo relationship with a little girl, you know, that's he has to hide. It creates all this genuine conflict. For one, with his roommate, Mike, now as the top scarer, as the Michael Jordan of scarers, Mike relies on Sully keeping his status as top scarer for everything he enjoys in Monster World, for his perks, for his status, for the girlfriend he has, for his
car. I remember the car.
Yeah. So all that depends on things staying as they are, with Sully being the star. So by trying to get this girl, by caring for her and trying to get her home, he's putting all that, his status, at risk. And so that creates real conflict between Mike and Sully. And so that's a source of a lot of comedy and genuine conflict, and it's based in character. It's not just artificially putting in something that's blocking them. And so when you have this now, Sully, as he moves forward towards pursuing the goal, it generates conflict and complication organically based on character. And so he's in conflict now with his company, with his society, with the other scares that he's, you know, competing with. And ultimately, he is in conflict with himself, because he is going to have to come and confront himself ultimately as someone who cares for this child and has made his life and living as someone who's very, very good at terrifying children and making them unhappy and cry. And so he has to, that's how it builds. And it builds, you know, in this organic way then, by bringing him, changing this sort of character constellation. Now you get the, each one of these relationships, for example, like with him and Mike becomes, and him and the society, and him with the head of the company, all become these story engines. Each step moving forward, deepening the relationship, creates more tension, more conflict and complication in a way that's natural, in a way that creates story energy. And that's a big fix.
And you telling me that, I would have never, I know the movie, I've seen it multiple times, I own it. So you're responsible for the way that really worked out, I take it, to some degree.
Yes. I mean, I can't, you know, there's so many people that contribute to making these movies great. I mean, really hundreds of people, but yes, that was my fix. That was, and it was tricky, and fortunately, John Lasseter was away. Not only fortunately for that, but fortunately Andrew Stanton, who was, you know, one of the very top creative people there, got it. He understood this right away. And we were in production. We have release dates, and we have tie-ins with products, and you know, that were tied to release dates, and we were in production, and he supported this idea to make these changes, and we could make them within the, you know, we didn't have to start over. And they were so skillful, but in employing these changes within the context of the framework that we had, and we were able to pull that off, I mean, to bring Sully up, to make him the star. And and the other thing was strengthening the idea at the end that the analog to real life, that when a child overcomes their fear, the monster that would scare them, that comes from the closet, no longer has access to them. And that's bittersweet, and has an analog in real life. As a child grows up, those monsters go away, and then the strength in that emotional core. So those two things really, really turned it around. And if you'd seen the movie, the way that it was going with Sully and Mike, you know, being trying to stay out of the limelight, working in the basement, it would have been funny. It would have been intriguing, but it would not have been the powerful movie that it became.
And it is powerful. Yeah, I love a lot of what Pixar has done, and I didn't know that Steve Jobs owned it. That's new to me.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea.
He was a great boss. He would come over and come to screenings and sit in top-level story meetings, and he would give his ideas, and they were no more or less important than any of the other creative people there. And he really respected that process, and he really got it that if you hire great people, you give them the room, you let them do what they do within the framework of budgets and deadlines. And that was one of the, you know, extraordinary and fabulous things about Pixar and Apple as well.
Oh, be darn. I had no idea. And, you know, I'm thinking about the movies that you've talked about. I'm thinking about, you know, Hogwarts. I'm thinking about John Williams and the music. At some level, when we're watching a movie or listening to something, we know that there was an awful lot of work that went through it. But I'm wondering how many of us really understand or even think about the sheer creativity that has to pull together at the right time. People have to really work. They have to really listen to one another. It doesn't just, you know, a storyboard and all, it's a movie. It just, that's not how it works. I'm stunned by the level of creativity that y'all have to work with or are fortunate enough to work with, and you can make just magical things happen.
Yes. And I think, you know, the art of, you know, that Ed Catmull brought as our president was, like I said, that, you know, to create these environments and teams of people that could make magic. And really have respect for that. And then we had just, you know, some brilliant directors, you know, John Lasseter and Andrew Stanton, just a brilliant director, Pete Docter, who's his idea for Monsters, Inc. was the start of all that. And it was this great, you know, coalescing of creative people that wanted to have the intention to do something special. And I remember Andrew, you know, when I first got there and talking with him and brought up something about making movies for kids, he said, we don't make movies for kids. We make movies for ourselves. We make, you know, movies that make us laugh and cry and what we want to see. And if they entertain us on a high level, we believe they're going to entertain other people on the same high level. And that was what made those films so successful, was that they worked for different audiences. And I remember John Lasseter one time saying, I want to make movies that I can bring my five boys to, which, you know, it was quite a range there, bring my wife to and bring my mother to, and they will all enjoy them. And I think they succeeded in that, especially then.
Well, and see, that makes sense to me. If I don't enjoy, if you don't grab my attention in the first 5, 6, 7 minutes, I'm gone. I leave. I have been known to actually walk out of a theater. It's like, I am not going to sit around for this. It didn't matter how highly rated it was. The last movie I saw was Top Gun Maverick. Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating movie. Before that, I think it was one of the Downton Abbey movies. A friend of mine talked me into going. That was many years ago. Before that, it was Harry Potter. I don't really enjoy being in a theater because it's people-y in there. there's people and they talk and they chew popcorn. I don't like to pee in there. But once I find a movie that I really, really love, like Monsters, Inc. and WALL-E, I buy them. You know, I've got them here. I can watch them whenever I want to. And, you know, it's funny how some of these, you know, movies just, they evoke so much emotion. I've got a kind of a snarky little exchange going on with friends on Facebook who insist that Die Hard is a Christmas movie. No, it's not. and, you know, we're going back and forth, and they're insisting that I'm a Debbie Downer and that I'm wrong, and I'm just saying, nope, it is not a Christmas movie. But that's how these things impact us and how they affect us. I tried to watch it. I like, you know, almost all of the actors in it. 5 minutes, I was out. I was gone. Same thing with The Matrix. Hated it. You know, there are some movies that are going to grab you, and others you're going to go, oh, I must have you. I'll keep you forever.
Yes, and I think that, you know, when I talk about, you know, how these movies work, what makes them, what's essential, and one thing I start with is, you know, the idea of verisimilitude, the semblance of truth, a reason to care about the characters and story. And it comes down to both story logic, like, is this what a person would actually do or say or think? And the other part is emotional truth. Are the longings, fears, decisions, and actions of this character real, measured instantly by our knowing and by our depths of our, by the depth of our experience as human beings? And if the story logic is off from the beginning, if we just don't buy it, we disconnect. We're disconnected from the story. And like I said, you walk out. And if I could just say one, switch gears for, I tried to bring all those things to the first book that I've, this is a kind of a leap of a segue, but I hope you'll allow me this, but apply all these same principles to my first novel. It's a middle grade novel that we thought of originally as an animated feature that might go to Pixar. And during the pandemic, my writing partner Mark Loria, who was a terrific screenwriter and novelist, said, "Well, let's write it as a book." And we did, and it was based on this idea of like a newspaper article I saw, I don't know, you know, 20, 30 years ago. It's a little piece in the back of the New York Times about the invasion of Iraq, of Baghdad, a little piece about the Baghdad Zoo and how it was bombed. And some of the animals, a lot of them were killed in the moment, and some were taken as pets, some were taken and eaten. Some zoo people, the workers, came and tried to feed them for a while, and some of them escaped, and no one knows whatever happened to them. So the story called Journey to the Kingdom is the story of these one community of zoo animals that escape when their zoo is blown up in war and have to find their way across a war-torn country to this legendary animal sanctuary called Animal Kingdom. And so it's a really heartfelt story, and it's very much in line with how the Pixar stories work.
Is it available now? Can it be read? Can it be purchased?
We just finished it, and we're sending it out to agents. And here's a funny little story I can end with, is that we sent it. We've just been sending it out, trying to get a literary agent involved with it. And one of the first ones that read the whole manuscript wrote back and said, you know, this story is really something. It has this really classic feel to it, like and it's very cinematic, and it has a classic feel like Dumbo or The Incredible Journey. She said, I sobbed at the end, and I'm going to pass on it because it's too old-fashioned for this market. And Okay. Well, let me see if I can sort that out. But it'll find its way out there. It's a beautiful, beautiful story. I'm very proud of it.
What's wrong with old-fashioned? Say, I'm offended on your behalf.
Gee, Denise, I accept your feelings. But,
so many of the stories that grab us and stay with us are old-fashioned. I don't know by design, but they speak to something in us that I think, I'm going to stutter here, I'm trying to figure out what I want to say, but they speak to us at almost a cellular level, good versus bad, mm-hmm. you know, high versus low, things that we were taught as children, you know, things that we know really to be true. What is wrong with old-fashioned?
Mm. Yeah. That's why we always go back and love classic stories and classic, you know, books and movies, because they have that. They don't go in and out of fashion with the time. And I think, you know, the Pixar movies are like that. And I think this book is like that, Journey to the Kingdom, and that that it's a story with heart, you know, like those classic films that that you could relate to, you know, 50 years from now. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz. You watch mm-hmm. those when you're children. They don't ever leave you. And frankly, I don't know if anybody hates them. I just don't. So she's wrong. She's just wrong. Sorry. I can't wait to read it. When you've got it where you can, you know, send it out, or you can send out a you know, pre-publishing book, I'd love to read it if you don't mind.
I would love to have you read it, Denise.
Oh, good.
I'll figure out
and I will,
talk
too.
To Mark.
Say it again, I'm sorry.
I'll talk to Mark, my writing partner, and see when we could do that. We're doing some little revisions right now. So, but thank you for your support. Appreciate that.
Oh, my pleasure. Listen, we've only got a couple more minutes. We started out talking about business, and so much of what you were sharing today applies to business. It really does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how you operate, how you tell stories, how you share with people, how you work with people. Steve Jobs that's an amazing story. I just didn't know that. So right now, when you're working, you're focusing on writing, repairing, and developing stories and scripts for all genres of live-action projects and animated features and shorts. So
yes.
You're working
and
hard.
Also,
I mean, go ahead.
I've also worked for, worked on a story, origin story for a character for Ogilvy Paris on their Lou Cookie campaign, where they have the king and King of Lou, and that was fun to do. Now I'm consulting on a documentary, so it's all storytelling. And I think, you know, for in business, that you mentioned this, you were just talking about, you know, how people work together, having a common goal to get it right, and giving them the respect and the room to get the best out of people. You can see from those, the products, what was produced in those early days, how that paid off.
Absolutely. Well, listen, you have 60 seconds. I told you this is a fast 60 minutes. Do you have anything else you want to share with the audience before I reluctantly let you go?
I don't want to start on another idea, but part of working with people and stories, that, you know, they're very vulnerable, and how we treat each other, and those, you know, being creative and with other people's ideas is really important, I think. You know, when I work with people, and there are different levels, you know, I just look for what's good in the story, and in what they have. Even if it's sometimes it's a big mess, I try to find something that's working, something, the elements that are strong and vivid and true, and try and nourish them. And I point out what I love and respond to, try to shed light on those things and encourage them and, you know, play with that, go with that, develop that, and come back with your ideas and let's see where to go from there.
I love that. Will, it has been, where can people find you before I ask any more questions? Where can they locate you?
They can locate me at story-repair.com. And I'm on LinkedIn, but through the website there's a way to contact me. It's story-repair.com.
Okay.
And that tells all about what I do.
It does. It's a great website.
Thank you. Thank you, Denise.
Oh, Will, it has been my pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing all these terrific stories. And seriously, I don't drink coffee, but I just drank a big old cup of tea, but my brain is going zit, zit. I'm scribbling down notes. I've got so many ideas. Like, for the longest kind of time, I had no idea I was a creative, but now that I do know that about me, when I listen to people like you, my brain just, I can hear it just firing. I mean, it's like my hair is curling, you know. All by itself. It's like these little zips are sending my curls up into the stratosphere. I have very curly hair. But thank you.
That. So great to hear. Thank you.
And it's true. I mean, I just put my hand on my head and I can feel my hair moving around because my brain activity is just on fire right now listening to these stories. But it has been wonderful chatting with you, and I really look forward to reading the book. So do me a favor, once that book is out into the wild, come back. Come back to the show.
I'd love to, Denise. Thank you so much.
Okay, great. Well, listen, thank you, everybody. Before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us on iTunes, Amazon Prime, Audible, Spotify. We're everywhere. You can't throw a stick on the Internet without hitting your partner in Success Radio. So find us and take us along on your success journey and go look for Will. Right now, before you forget. Will, thank you.
Thank you, Denise.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.